straightened it completely. "This is your pick," he said. "What you're holding is the tension wrench."
"Okay," she said. "Now, how do you pick the lock?"
He laughed.
"Hold your horses. Okay, pick up the padlock. You're going to take the tension wrench and insert it into the bottom of the keyhole, which is called the shear line."
Drew did as he'd instructed. Her tongue poked out one corner of her mouth. She looked like a little girl concentrating on a book.
"Turn it in the direction that the lock would turn," he said. "Not left. There you go. Like that. Now, take the pick with your other hand."
"No, wait," she laughed. "That's confusing."
"Okay, I'll show you."
He slid the second clip into the lock itself and began to rake it back and forth, trying to push the pins up. His father had taught him how to feel the pins with his lock pick. This lock had 5, and he began to fiddle gently, raising one pin after another.
"Turn the wrench," he said suddenly, and Drew jumped. "Turn it to the right."
She twisted, and the padlock popped open. Drew gave a muted scream.
"That is so cool!"
Kit felt like smiling at her. It had never occurred to him to want a little sister, but there was something nice about having someone to teach things to.
"Does Ty know how to do this?" she asked.
"I don't think so," Kit said, relocking the padlock and handing it to her. "But he'd probably learn fast." He handed her the pick next and sat back.
"Now, you do it,"
she groaned.
"Oh, not fair."
"You only learn by doing." It was something Kit's father had always said.
"You sound like Julian."
Drew puffed out a little laugh and started in on the padlock. Her fingernails were painted with chipped black polish. Kit was impressed with the delicacy with which she handled the pick and wrench.
"I never thought anyone would say I sounded like Julian Blackthorne."
Drew looked up.
"You know what I mean. Dad-ish." She twisted the tension wrench. "I'm glad you're friends with Ty," she said unexpectedly.
Kit felt his heart give a sudden sharp bump in his chest.
"I mean, he always had Livy, so he didn't need any other friends. It was like a little club and no one could get in, and then you came along, and you did."
She had paused, still holding the padlock.
She was looking at him with eyes so much like Livy's, wide, blue-green fringed with dark lashes. "I'm sorry," he said.
"Don't be. I'm too young. Ty would never have let me in, even if you hadn't shown up," she said it matter-of-factly.
"I love Julian. He's like the best father.
You know he'll always put you first.
But Ty was always my cool brother. He had such awesome stuff in his room, and animals liked him, and he knew everything."
She broke off, her cheeks turning pink. Ty had come in, his damp hair in soft, humid curls, and Kit felt a slow flip inside him, like his stomach turning over. He told himself he probably felt awkward because Ty had walked in on them, talking about him.
"I'm learning how to pick locks," Drew said.
"Okay." Ty spared her a cursory glance. "I need to talk to Kit now, though." Kit slid hastily off the table, nearly knocking over the pile of paper clips.
"Drew did pretty well," he said.
"Okay," Ty said again, "but I need to talk to you."
"So talk," said Drew.
She'd put the lock-picking equipment down on the table and was glaring at Ty.
"Not with you here," he said.
It had been pretty obvious, but Drew made a hurt noise anyway and jumped off the table. She stalked out of the library, slamming the door behind her.
"That wasn't... she wasn't..."
Kit started. He couldn't finish, though. He couldn't scold Ty. Not now. Ty unzipped his hoodie and reached brusquely into an inner pocket.
"We need to go to the shadow market tonight," he said.
Kit yanked his brain back to the present.
"I'm forbidden from entering the market. I suspect you are, too."
"We can petition at the gate," said Ty. "I read about people doing that. Shadow markets have gates, right?"
"Yeah, there are gates. They're marked off. They don't keep people in or out. They're more like meeting points.
And yeah, you can petition the head of the market, except in this case it's Barnabas, and he hates me." Ty picked up a paperclip from the table and looked at it with interest. There were bruises on his neck, Kit noticed suddenly. He didn't remember them, which struck him as strange. But then, who noticed every bruise on someone else's skin? Ty must have gotten them when he'd fought the writers in London. We just have to convince him it's in his interest to let us in.
How do you plan to do that? We're not exactly master negotiators.
Ty, who had been straightening the paperclip, gave Kit one of his rare sunrise-over-the-water smiles.
You are?
Kit realized he was grinning and broke off. He'd always had a sarcastic edge to his tongue, never been someone to take compliment gracefully. But it was as if there was something about Ty Blackthorne that reached into him and untied all the careful knots of protection holding him together. He wondered if that was what people meant when they said they felt undone. Ty frowned as if he hadn't noticed Kit's stupid smile.
The problem is, he said, neither of us drive. We have no way of getting to the market.
But you have an iPhone, said Kit. In fact, there's several in the Institute. I've seen them.
Sure, said Ty, but...
I'm going to introduce you to a wonderful invention called Uber, said Kit.
Your life will be changed, Ty Blackthorne.
Ah, Watson, said Ty, shoving the clip into his pocket. You may not yourself be luminous, but you are an extraordinary conductor of light.
Diego had been surprised that Gladstone wanted to lock them in the library. He'd never thought of it as a particularly secure room. Once they were both inside, Diego stripped of his weapons and steely, and the solid oak door had been locked behind them, Diego began to realize the advantages the library had as a prison. The walls were thick, and there were no windows, save for the massive glass ceiling many feet up. The sheer walls made it impossible to climb up and break it, and nothing in the room yielded a useful weapon. They could throw books, Diego supposed, or try to flip the tables, but he didn't figure how that would do much good. He stalked over to where Kieran sat slumped at the foot of a massive tree that grew up out of the floor. If only it reached up high enough to get to the ceiling, Diego thought. Kieran was hunched against the tree. He had jammed the palms of his hands into his eyes, as if he could blind himself.
Are you all right? Diego said.
Kieran dropped his hands.
I am sorry.
He looked up at Diego, who could see the marks of Kieran's palms against his cheekbones.
It's fine. You were injured. I can look for ways out by myself, said Diego, deliberately misunderstanding him.
No. I mean, I am sorry, Kieran choked out. I cannot.
You cannot what?
Get away from it. I feel guilt, like a curtain of thorns in which I am entangled. Every which way I turn, I am pierced again.
The pool makes you feel every hurt you have ever caused others.
We are none of us without guilt, said Diego, and he thought of his family, of Christina. Every one of us has hurt another, inadvertently or not.
You do not understand.
Kieran was shaking his head. A lock of hair fell across his forehead, silver darkening to blue. When I was in the hunt, I was a straw floating in the wind or water. All I could do was clutch at other straws. I believed I had no effect in the world, that I mattered so little that I could neither help nor harm. He tensed his hands into fists.
Now I felt the pain that was Emma's, and the sorrow that was Mark's. The pain of everyone I harmed in the hunt. Even Erek's pain as he died. But how could I have been the person who caused so much pain, when I am someone whose actions are written in water?
His eyes, black and silver, were haunted. Diego said,
Kieran, you have not caused only pain in this world. It is just that the pool does not show good, only hurt.
How do you know? Kieran cried. We are but barely acquainted, you and I. Because of Christina, said Diego. Christina had faith in you. True faith, unblemished and unbroken. Why do you think I agreed to hide you here? Because she believed you were good, and I believed in her.
He stopped before I could say too much, but Kieran had already winced at the mention of Christina. His next question puzzled Diego.
How can I face her again? He said.
Do you care that much what she thinks? Diego said. It hadn't occurred to him that Kieran might. Surely he didn't know Christina that well.
More than you might imagine or guess, Kieran said.
How did you ever face her again? After you engaged yourself to Zara and broke her heart.
Really? Diego was stung. We need to bring this up now? Kieran looked at him with wild eyes. Diego sighed.
Yes, I disappointed Christina, and I lost her regard.
You must understand what it is like, to have let down someone you loved, to have disappointed yourself.
Maybe not exactly, said Kieran, with a shadow of his old wryness. Nobody calls me perfect Kieran.
I don't call myself perfect, Diego, Diego protested, feeling that the conversation had degenerated. Nobody would call themselves that.
There was a noise at the door. Both of them turned, poised for danger, but as it swung open, Diego was shocked to see Divya on the threshold. She looked like she'd been in a fight. Scratched and bloody, she held up the key.
I got it from Gladstone in the infirmary chaos, she said. I doubt we have much time before he notices it's gone.
Diego stalked past her and opened the library door a crack. The corridor was empty.
What's happening? Where's Rian?
Trying to see what the others know, the ones who came from Alicante and who aren't in the cohort. Everyone's steelies have been confiscated. Zara portaled back to Idris right after you took Kieran away. And Gladstone's in the infirmary with Samantha, said Divya.
She won't stop screaming, she bit her lip. It's really bad.
Kieran had risen to his feet, though he was still using the tree to support himself.
You two should run, he said. Get out of here. It's me they want, and you have put yourselves in enough danger on my account.
Divya gave him a wry look.
By the angel, he's all self-sacrificing now he fell in that pool. Fairy, you haven't caused me any harm. We're fine.
I made you worry and feel fear, said Kieran, gazing at her with a look both haunting and haunted. You were afraid of what might happen to you and the others. Retaliation for hiding me. You feared for Rayon, he glanced at Diego. And you?
No, Diego held up a hand. I don't want to hear about my feelings.
Said every man ever,
Divya quipped, but her eyes were overly bright.
Look, there's more I need to tell you, and you should both hear it. I heard Zara laughing with Gladstone in the infirmary before they brought Samantha in. The Inquisitor sent two shadow hunters on a suicide mission to Fairy to find the Black Volume.
Jace and Clary? Said Diego, puzzled. That's not a suicide mission.
Not them. Emma and Julian Blackthorne. They left yesterday.
They would never agree to a suicide mission, said Kieran. Julian would not leave his brothers and sisters. Never.
They don't know it's a suicide mission. Dearborn sent someone to follow them and kill them before they come back.
That's against the law. It was all Diego could think of to say, but he immediately felt ridiculous.
Horace Dearborn doesn't care about your laws, said Kieran.
His cheeks were flushed darkly with color.
He cares for nothing beyond furthering his own purpose. To him, a Nephilim who doesn't agree with him is no better than a downworlder. They are all vermin to be destroyed.
Kieran's right, said Divya. He's the Inquisitor, Diego. He's going to change all the laws. Change them so he can do whatever he wants.
We must go, said Kieran. There is not a moment to lose. We must tell the Blackthorns, Mark and Christina.
All the exits are guarded, said Divya. I'm not saying it's impossible, but we're going to need Rayan and Jen and the others. We can't fight the cohort alone, especially without Steelies. We'll need a plan.
We do not have time for a plan, Kieran began.
Diego thought suddenly of Christina, of the way she'd written about Kieran in her letter asking Diego to hide him. The fascination she'd had with fairies, even when she was a little girl. The way she'd cried when the cold peace was passed, telling Diego over and over the fairies were good, their powers part of the blessed magic of the world.
Kieran, Diego said sharply, you are Prince of Fairy. Be a Prince of Fairy.
Kieran gave him a wild, dark look. His breath was ragged. Divya glanced at Diego as if to say, what are you doing? Just as Kieran reached up to seize a branch of the tree. He closed his black and silver eyes. His face was a pale mask. His jaw tightened, even as the leaves on the tree began to rustle, as if in a high wind. It was as if the tree were calling out.
What's happening? Whispered Divya.
Light crackled up and down the tree. Not lightning, but pure, bright sparks. It circled Kieran as if he were outlined in gold paint. His hair had turned an odd gold green, something Diego had never seen before.
Kieran? Diego started.
Kieran threw his hands up. His eyes were still closed. Words poured from his mouth. A language Diego had never heard. He wished Christina were here. Christina could translate. Kieran was shouting. Diego thought he heard the word wind spear repeated.
Wind spear, thought Diego. Isn't that...
There are people coming,
Divya cried. She ran to the door of the library, slammed it closed, and locked it, but she was shaking her head.
There are too many of them. Diego!
The glass ceiling exploded. Both Diego and Divya gasped. A white horse crashed through the ceiling. A flying white horse, proud and beautiful. Glass sprayed, and Diego dived under a nearby table, dragging Divya with him. Kieran opened his eyes. He reached up in welcome as Windspear sliced through the air, swift as an arrow, light as thistledown.
By the angel, Divya whispered. Good, I used to love ponies when I was little.
Kieran vaulted himself onto Windspear's back. His hair had gone back to its more normal blue-black, but he was still crackling with energy. His hands threw sparks as he moved. He reached out toward Diego, who scrambled out from under the table, Divya beside him, their boots crunching on shattered glass. Come with me, Kieran called. The room was full of wind and cold, the smell of the Carpathians and lake water. Above them, the broken window opened out into a sky full of stars.
You will not be safe here.
But Divya shook her head. Crushing down the longing to escape that rose inside him, Diego did the same.
We will stay and fight, he called. We are shadow hunters. We cannot flee and leave only the worst of us to seize power. We must resist.
Kieran hesitated, just as the library door burst open. Gladstone and a dozen cohort members swarmed in, their eyes widening.
Stop him!
Gladstone shouted, throwing an arm out toward Kieran.
Manuel! Anoush! Kieran, go!
Diego roared, and Kieran seized Windspear's mane. They exploded into the air before Manuel could do more than take a step forward. Diego thought he saw Kieran look back at him once before Windspear cleared the ceiling and they shimmered into a white streak across the sky. Diego heard someone step up behind him. Across the room, Divya was looking at him. There were tears in her eyes. Behind her, her cousin Anoush was cuffing her hands.
You are going to be so sorry you did this, Manuel said, his delighted whisper rasping in Diego's ear. So very sorry, Rocío Rosales. And then there was only darkness.
Emma was taken up behind Neen on her gray palfrey, while Julian rode behind Fergus, so there was no chance to talk. Frustration churned in Emma as they rode along under the green trees, the golden spears of light that drove down through the gaps in the trees turning to deeper bronze as the day wore on. She wanted to talk to Julian, wanted to make a plan for what they were going to do when they reached the Seelie court. What would they say to the queen? How would they get out again? What did they want from her? But part of her was also too angry to talk to Julian. How dare he keep a massive part of their plan from her? Let her walk blind into Faerie, believing they had one mission when apparently they had another? And a smaller, colder part of her said, "The only reason he wouldn't tell you is if he knew you'd refuse to go along with his plan." Whatever the plan was, Emma wasn't going to like it. And down even deeper, where she barely had the words for what she felt, she knew that if it weren't for the spell, Julian would never have done this, because she had never been one of the people Julian manipulated and lied to. She was family, inside a protected circle, and because of that, she had forgiven the lies, the plans, because they hadn't been directed at her. They'd been directed at the enemies of the family. The Julian who had to lie and manipulate was a persona created by a frightened child to protect the people he loved. But what if the spell had made the persona real? What if that was who Julian was now? They had left the forest behind and were in a place of green fields that showed no sign of habitation. Just waving green grass for miles, starred with patches of blue and purple flowers and dim violet mountains in the distance. A hill rose up in front of them like a green tidal wave, and Emma chanced a glance at Julian as the front of the hill rose like a portcullis, revealing a massive marble entryway. Things in Faerie rarely looked the same twice, Emma knew. The last time they'd entered the Seely Court through a hill, they'd found themselves in a narrow corridor. Now they rode under an elegant bronze gate, boasting scrollwork of prancing horses. Neen and Fergus dismounted, and it was only after Emma had slid to the marble floor that she saw that both horses' reins had been taken up by diminutive fluttering fairies with outspread wings of blue and red and gold. The horses clopped off, led by the buzzing pixies. "I could use one of those to do my hair in the morning," said Emma to Neen, who gave her an unreadable smile. It was unnerving how much Neen looked like Mark, the same curling white-blonde hair and narrow bones. Fergus narrowed his eyes. "My son is married to a diminutive pixie," he said. "Please do not ask any intrusive questions about it." Julian raised his eyebrows but said nothing. He and Emma fell into step beside each other as they followed Neen and Fergus from the marble-clad room into an earth-packed corridor that twisted into the hill. "I guess everything went according to your plan, didn't it?" Emma said coldly, not looking at Julian. She could feel him beside her, though, the familiar warmth and shape of him, her Parabatai, who she would have known deafened and blindfolded. "If you're lying about having the black volume, it's going to go badly for both of us."
"I'm not lying," he said. "There was a copy shop near the London Institute. You'll see."
"We weren't supposed to leave the Institute, Julian."
"This was the best option," said Julian. "You may be too sentimental to see it clearly, but this gets us closest to what we want."
"How does it do that?" Emma hissed. "What's the point of coming to the Seely Queen? We can't trust her, any more than we could trust Horace or Annabelle."
Julian's eyes glittered like the precious stones set into the walls of the long tunnel. They gleamed in stripes of jasper and quartz. The ground underfoot had become polished tile, a milky green-white.
"Not trusting the queen is part of my plan." Emma wanted to kick a wall.
"You shouldn't have a plan that includes the queen at all, don't you get it? We're all dealing with a cold piece because of her treachery."
"Such anti-fairy sentiments," Julian said, ducking under a gray curtain of lace.
"I'm surprised at you." Emma stalked after him.
"It's nothing to do with fairies in general, but the queen is a no-holes-barred bit.
Why, hello, Your Majesty."
Oh, crap.
It seemed that the gray curtain they'd passed through was the entrance to the queen's court. The queen herself was seated in the middle of the room, on her throne, regarding Emma coldly. The chamber looked as it had before, as if a fire had swept through the room years ago and no one had truly cleaned up the damage. The floor was blackened, cracked marble. The queen's throne was tarnished bronze, the back of it rising high above her head in a fan-shaped scroll. The walls were gouged here and there, as if a massive beast had dug out clots of marble with its claws. The queen was flame and bone. Her bony clavicles rose from the bodice of her intricately figured blue and gold dress. Her long bare arms were thin as sticks. All around her tumbled her rich, deep red hair in thick waves of blood and fire. From her narrow, white face, blue eyes blazed like gas flames. Emma cleared her throat.
"The queen is a no-holes-barred bit of sunshine," she said. "That's what I was going to say."
"You will not greet me in that informal manner, Emma Carstairs," she said. "Do you understand?"
"They were waylaid on the road and attacked," said Neen. "We sent pixie messengers ahead to tell you."
"I heard," said the queen. "That does not excuse rudeness."
"I think the blonde one was about to call the queen a besom," Fergus murmured to Neen, who looked as exasperated as fairy courtiers ever looked.
"So true," said Emma. "Kneel," snapped the queen. "Kneel, Emma Carstairs and Julian Blackthorne, and show proper respect."
Emma felt her chin go up as if it had been pulled on a string.
"We are Nephilim," she said. "We do not kneel." "Because once the Nephilim were giants on earth, with the strength of 1,000 men," the queen's tone was gently mocking. "How the mighty have fallen."
Julian took a step toward the throne. The queen's eyes raked him up and down, assessing, measuring.
"Would you rather an empty gesture or something you truly want?" he asked.
The queen's blue eyes flashed.
"You are suggesting you have something I truly want? Think carefully. 'Tis not easy to guess what a monarch desires."
"I have the black volume of the dead," Julian said. The queen laughed.
"I had heard you had lost that," she said, "along with the life of your sister."
Julian whitened, but his expression didn't change.
"You never specified which copy of the black volume you wanted."
As the queen and Emma both stared, he reached into his pack and pulled out a bound white manuscript. Holes were punched into the left side, the whole thing held together with thick plastic ties. The queen sat back, her flame-red hair brilliant against the dark metal of her throne.
"That is not the black volume."
"I think you will find, if you examine the pages, that it is," said Julian. "A book is the words it contains, nothing more. I took photos of every page of the black volume with my phone and had it printed and bound at a copy shop."
The queen tilted her head, and the thin gold circle binding her brow flashed.
"I do not understand the words of your mortal spells and rituals," she said.
Her voice had risen to a sharp pitch. Behind her sometimes mocking, sometimes laughing eyes, Emma thought she caught a glimpse of the true queen, and what would happen if one crossed her, and she felt chilled.
"I will not be tricked or mocked, Julian Blackthorne, and I do not trust your mischief. Neen, take the book from him and examine it."
Neen stepped forward and held out her hand. In the shadowy corners of the room there was movement. Emma realized the walls were lined with fairy guards in gray uniforms. No wonder they'd allowed her and Julian to enter, still carrying their weapons. There must be 50 guards here, and more in the tunnels.
"Let Neen have the book, Julian," she thought, and indeed he handed it over without a murmur.
He watched calmly as Neen looked it over, her eyes flicking over the pages. At last she said,
"This was made by a very skilled calligrapher. The brushstrokes are exactly as I remember."
"A skilled calligrapher named Office Max," Julian muttered, but Emma didn't smile at him. The queen was silent for a long time. The tapping of her slipper-shod foot was the only sound in the room as they all waited for her to speak. At last, she said,
"This is not the first time you have presented me with a perplexing issue, Julian Blackthorne, and I suspect it will not be the last. It shouldn't be perplexing, said Julian. It's the Black Volume. And you said if we gave you the Black Volume, you would help us.
Not quite, said the Queen. I recall making promises, but some may no longer be relevant.
I am asking you to remember that you promised us aid, said Julian. I am asking you to help us find Annabel Blackthorne here in Faerie.
We're already here to find her, Emma said. We don't need this person's help, she glared at the Queen.
We have a map that barely works, said Julian. The Queen will have spies all over Faerie. It could take us weeks to find Annabel. We could wander in Faerie forever while our food runs out. The Queen could lead us right to her. Nothing happens in this realm she doesn't know about.
The Queen smirked.
And what do you want of Annabel when you find her? The second Black Volume?
Yes, said Julian. You can keep this copy. I need to take the original Black Volume back with me to Idris to prove to the Clave that it's no longer in the hands of Annabel Blackthorne.
He paused. And I want revenge. Pure and simple revenge.
There is nothing simple about vengeance, and nothing pure, said the Queen. But her eyes glittered with interest.
If the Queen knew so much, why didn't she just go kill Annabel and take the Black Volume? Emma wondered. Because of the involvement of the Unseelie Court?
But she kept her mouth shut. It was clear she and Julian were in no way in agreement on the Queen.
Before, you wished for an army, said the Queen. Now you only want me to find Annabel for you.
It's a better bargain for you, said Julian, and Emma noticed that he hadn't said yes. He wanted more than this from the Queen.
Perhaps, but I will not be the final word on this volume's merit, said the Queen. I must have an expert agree first. And you will remain in the court until that is done.
No, Emma said. We will not stay an unspecified amount of time in Faerie. She spun on Julian. That's how they get you, unspecified amounts of time.
I will watch over the two of you, said Neen unexpectedly, for the sake of Mark. I will watch over you and make sure no harm comes to you. The Queen shot Neen an unfriendly look before returning her gaze to Emma and Julian.
What do you say?
I'm not sure, Julian said. We paid a high price for this book in blood and loss. To be told to wait...
Oh, very well, said the Queen.
And in her eyes, Emma saw an odd light of eagerness. Perhaps she was more desperate for the book than Emma had thought.
As a sign of my good faith... I will give you part of what I promised. I will tell you, Julian, how certain bonds might be broken, but I will not tell her, she gestured at Emma. That was not part of the bargain.
Emma heard him inhale sharply. Julian's feelings for her might be deadened, she thought, but for whatever reason, he still wanted this desperately. The knowledge of how their bond might be dissolved. Perhaps it was an atavistic want, as he had described his desire to protect Ty, a deep-rooted need for survival.
Neen, said the Queen, please escort Emma to the room she inhabited the last time she was a guest of the court.
Fergus groaned. It had been his bedroom Emma and Julian had slept in previously. Neen approached the Queen, placed the copy of the Black Volume at her feet, and backed away to stand at Emma's side. The Queen smiled with her red lips.
Julian and I will remain here and speak in private, she said. Guards, you may leave me.
Leave us.
I don't need to, Emma said. I know what this is about. Breaking all Parabatai bonds. We don't need to hear about it. It's not going to happen. The Queen's gaze was scornful.
Little fool, she said. You probably think you are protecting something sacred, something good.
I know it's something you wouldn't understand, Emma said.
What would you say, said the Queen, if I said to you, there is a corruption at the heart of the bond of Parabatai, a poison, a darkness in it that mirrors its goodness? There is a reason Parabatai cannot fall in love, and it is monstrous beyond all you could imagine. Her mouth shimmered like a poisoned apple as she smiled. The Parabatai rune was not given to you by the angel, but by men. And men are flawed. David the Silent and Jonathan Shadowhunter created the rune, and the ceremony. Do you imagine that carries no consequences? It was true, and Emma knew it. The Parabatai rune was not in the Grey Book, but neither was the Alliance rune Clary had created, and that was regarded as a universal good. The Queen was twisting the truth to suit herself, as she always did. Her eyes, fixed on Emma's, were shards of blue ice. I see you do not understand, she said. But you will. Before Emma could protest, Neen took her arm. Come, she murmured, while the Queen is still in a good mood. Emma glanced at Julian. He hadn't moved from where he was, his back rigid, his gaze fixed firmly on the Queen. Emma knew she should say something. Protest. Tell him not to listen to the Queen's trickster words. Tell him that there was no way, no matter what was at stake, that they could justify the shattering of every Parabatai bond in the world. Even if it would free them. Even if it would give Julian back to her. She couldn't force the words out. She walked out of the Queen's chamber beside Neen without another word. Chapter 10. Many a Marvelous Shrine. The sight of the Shadow Market sent a punch of familiarity through Kit's chest. It was a typical Los Angeles night. The temperature had dropped as soon as the sun set, and a cool wind blew through the empty lot where the market was, making the dozens of fairy bells that hung from the corners of the white-canopied booths chime. Ty had been full of suppressed excitement all the way there in the back of the Uber car, which he dealt with by pushing up the sleeve of Kit's shirt and giving him several runes. Kit had three of them, night vision, agility, and one called talent, which Ty told him would make him more persuasive. Now they were standing at the circumference of the market, having been dropped off in Kendall Alley. They were both dressed as mundanely as possible, in jeans, zip-front jackets, and fry boots. But Ty was still visibly a shadow hunter. He held himself like one, he walked like one, and looked like one, and there were even runes visible on the delicate skin of his neck and wrists. And bruises, too. All over the sides of his hands. The kind no mundane boy would have any business getting, unless he was in an illegal fight club. It wouldn't have mattered if he could have covered them up, though. Shadow hunters seemed to bleed their angel heritage through their pores. Kit wondered if he himself did yet. I don't see any gates, Ty said, craning his head. The gates are metaphysical, not exactly real, Kit explained. They were walking toward the section of the market where potions and charms were sold. A booth covered in tumbling roses in shades of red and pink and white sold love charms. One with a green and white awning sold luck and good fortune, and a pearly gray stand hung with curtains of lace, providing privacy, sold more dangerous items. Necromancy and death magic were both forbidden in the market, but the rules had never been strictly enforced. A puka was leaning against the post of a nearby street lamp, smoking a cigarette. Behind him, the lanes of the market looked like small, glowing streets, enticing Kit with calls of, Come! Buy! Voices clamored, jewelry clinked and rattled, spice and incense perfumed the air. Kit felt a longing mixed with anxiety. He cut a quick, sideways glance toward Ty. They hadn't entered the market yet. Was Ty thinking about how much he'd hated the London market? How it had made him sweat and panic with too much noise, too much light, too much pressure, too much everything. He wanted to ask Ty if he was all right, but he knew the other boy wouldn't want it. Ty was staring at the market, tense with curiosity. Kit turned to the puka.
Gatekeeper, he said. We request entrance to the Shadow Market. Tai's gaze snapped to attention. The puka was tall, dark, and thin, with bronze and gold strands threaded through his long hair. He wore purple trousers and no shoes. The lamppost he leaned against was between two stalls, neatly blocking the way into the market.
Kid Rook, said the puka. What a compliment it is, to still be recognized by one who's left us to dwell among the angels.
He knows you, muttered Tai. Everyone in the Shadow Market knows me, said Kit, hoping Tai would be impressed. The puka stubbed out his cigarette. It released a sickly, sweet smell of charred herbs.
Password, he said.
I'm not saying that, said Kit. You think it's funny to try to make people say that?
Say what? What's the password? Tai demanded. The puka grinned.
Wait here, Kid Rook, he said, and melted back into the shadows of the market.
He's going to get hail, said Kit, trying to hide the signs of his nerves. Can they see us? Tai said. He was looking into the Shadow Market, where clusters of downworlders, witches, and other assorted members of the magical underworld moved among the clamor. Out here? It was like standing outside a lighted room in the dark, Kit thought. And though Tai might not express it that way, Kit suspected he felt the same.
If they can, they'd never show it, he said.
Tai turned toward him suddenly. His gaze slipped over Kit's ear, his cheekbone not quite meeting his eyes. Watson.
Kit Rook and Tai Blackthorn,
snapped a voice out of the shadows. It was Barnabas Hale, head of the market.
Actually, I'm assuming you're not actually Kit Rook and Tai Blackthorn, because they'd never be stupid enough to show up here.
That seemed like a compliment, said Tai, who looked honestly surprised. Sure, maybe it's not us, said Kit. Maybe someone just got the specifications for the candygram you ordered wildly off. Hale frowned in annoyance. He looked like he always had, short and scaly-skinned, with a snake's slit-pupiled eyes. He wore a pinstriped suit that Kit assumed must have been heavily altered to fit. Most humans weren't 3 feet tall and 3 feet wide. The puka had returned with Hale. Silently, he leaned against the lamppost again, his dark eyes glittering.
Prove your Kit Rook, said Hale. What's the password?
I'm still not saying it. I'm never going to say it, said Kit.
What is it? Tai demanded.
Just let us in, said Kit. We don't want any trouble.
Hale barked out a laugh.
You don't want trouble. You two. You've got to be kidding me. Do you know what kind of mayhem you caused in London? You wrecked property, attacked vendors, and you, he pointed at Tai, destroyed a great deal of Fae stock. I hate you both. Go away.
Hear me out, said Kit. Remember when that fairy burned half the market down and was welcomed back the next year because she had a bumper crop of hen's teeth?
Remember the werewolf and the llama and how that turned out? And he wasn't banned because he had a line on a supply of yen fen.
What's your point, said Hale. He sighed. God, I wish I had a cigar. Had to quit.
The spirit of the market is simple, said Kit. Everything's okay as long as you make a profit, right?
Sure, said Hale. And that's why we tolerated Johnny Rook. We tolerated you because the Shadow Hunters hadn't found you yet. But now they have, and it's a hop, skip, and a jump until you find out who you really are.
What's that supposed to mean, said Tai. The wind had picked up and was blowing his dark hair like streamers.
Nothing for free, said Hale, with the annoyance of a man who'd said too much and who wanted a cigar and couldn't have one. Besides, your money is no good here, Rook.
He waved a hand in Ty's direction.
I might be able to get something in exchange for your skinny friend in the right circles, but not enough.
Theoretically, how much? Asked Tai with interest.
Hale looked grim.
Not as good a price as I'd get for Emma Carstairs. Even more for just her head.
Tai blanched. Kit felt it. Tai's recollection of the market was, in fact, truly dangerous. That it was all truly dangerous. Kit felt the situation was getting away from him.
No heads, look. My father didn't trust anyone, Mr. Hale. You know that.
He hid his most precious items all over Los Angeles, buried in places he thought no one would ever find them.
I'm listening, said Hale. Kit knew this was the risky part.
One is right here in the Shadow Market, a ruby-encrusted copy of the Red Scrolls of Magic. The Pooka whistled long and low.
Not only will I give it to you, I'll give it to you for free, said Kit. All you have to do is let us back into the Shadow Market. Free trade.
Hale shook his head in regret.
Now I really wish I had a cigar, so I could celebrate, he said. I already found that, you stupid brat. We dug up your dad's stall after the Mantids killed him.
He turned away, then paused, glanced back over his shoulder. The moonlight seemed to bounce off his white, scaled skin.
You're out of your depth, kids. Get out of Downworld before someone kills you. That person could even be me.
The forked tongue shot from between his teeth and licked his lips. Kit started back, revolted, as Hale melted into the market and was swallowed up by the crowds.
Kit couldn't look at Ty. He felt as if the air had been knocked out of him, shock and shame warring for an equal chance to turn his stomach.
He began.
You should have just given the password, said the Pooka.
Out of patience, Kit slowly raised his middle finger.
Here's your password.
Ty muffled a laugh and grabbed Kit's sleeve.
Come on, he said. Let's get out of here.
I am proud to announce, said Horace Dearborn, that the proposed Downworld Registry is ready to become a reality.
The sound that went through the rows of Nephilim seated in the council hall was hard to decipher. To Diana, it sounded like the roar of an animal driving another hungry beast away from its prey. Horace stood with his hands folded behind his back, a toneless smirk on his face. At his left stood Zara in full Centaurian regalia, her hair braided in a crown around her head. At his right was Manuel, his expression carefully blank, his eyes dancing with malice. They looked like a horrible mockery of a family portrait.
All institutes will have a short amount of time to register their local downworlders, said Horace. The heads of institutes must meet a quota of registrations based on our knowledge of local downworld populations. In the first weeks, this law takes effect.
Diana sat, letting the words wash over her in waves of horror. She couldn't help but look at Gia, who occupied a tall wooden seat at the edge of the dais. Her face was a strained mask. Diana couldn't help but wonder if this was more extreme even than what Gia had feared Horace might propose.
And if the downworlders refuse,
called someone from the audience,
then they will have their protections under the accords stripped from them, Zara said.
And Diana went cold all over. No accords protection meant a shadow hunter could kill a downworlder in the street for no reason, and there would be no consequences.
We understand this will be a great burden of work on institutes, but it is important that everyone cooperate for the good of all shadow hunters.
Each downworlder registered will be given a number, said Horace. If a downworlder is stopped by a shadow hunter for any reason, anywhere, they can be asked for this number.
The noise in the room was decidedly more worried now.
Think of it as an identification card, said Manuel. Safety and accountability are two of our chief concerns.
I want to hear from the consul,
shouted Carmen Delgado Mendoza, head of the Mexico City Institute, from the audience. She was Christina's mother and looked more than a little bit like her daughter.
Horace looked annoyed. Technically, as the one proposing a new law, he had the floor and could speak for a certain number of minutes uninterrupted. Diana felt he had already been speaking for several years. He gestured ungraciously toward Gia, who gripped the arms of her chair tightly.
It is my opinion that this law is not a good idea, she said. Downworlders will resist what they will see to be a major overreach on the part of the Nephilim. It establishes an atmosphere of mistrust.
That's because we don't trust them,
said Manuel. There was a gale of laughter from the back of the room. Diana could stand it no longer. She rose to her feet.
I have a question for the Inquisitor.
Horace looked at her with hooded eyes.
We will take questions and comments later, Diana.
Diana didn't like the emphasis he put on her name, as if he found it distasteful. Probably Zara had told her father a pack of lies about Diana. Diana had once humiliated Zara in front of her fellow Centaurians. Narcissists like Zara didn't forget insults.
Let her speak, said Gia. Everyone on the council has a voice.
Intensely aware of the eyes on her, Diana said,
This may seem like a small action, but it's not going to seem small to downworlders. It will have repercussions. Even if the registry is temporary, there will always be reasons to continue it. It is far harder to dismantle this sort of structure than it is to build it. We could face a situation where downworlders insist that shadow hunters also be registered, for parity. Are you prepared to have Nephilim carry their papers everywhere with them?
This had the desired effect. The council burst into angry buzzing.
No, never,
Dearborn snapped.
Then this effectively creates an underclass of downworlders, said Diana. We will have rights that they don't. Think about that.
Why are you so bothered by that idea, Diana Rayburn? Said Manuel in his soft, charming voice.
His eyes glittered like marbles.
Is there a downworlder, perhaps dear to you, that you worry will be affected?
Many shadow hunters have downworlders that are dear to them, said Diana evenly. You cannot cleanly sever us from a group of human beings who have more in common with us than mundanes do.
Diana knew the answer to that. We're not afraid of mundanes. It's downworlders we fear, and we seek to control what we fear. But it was unlikely Horace had that kind of self-awareness. He glared at her with open loathing as she took her seat.
This is clearly a complex issue, said Gia, rising to her feet. I suggest we stay this vote for a week until the council has had time to come to terms with all its ramifications.
Horace transferred his glare to her, but said nothing. The council was now a hum of relief, and even Horace Dearborn knew better than to fly directly in the face of popular opinion during a vote. He stayed on the dais as the meeting was dismissed, his supporters flocking around him in a thick crowd. Feeling inexpressibly weary, Diana made for the exits. She felt as if she had been called to witness a bloody execution, only to see the victim spared for a week. Relief mixed with fear of what the future would bring.
Diana,
said a light, accented voice behind her. Diana turned to see one of the women from the Barcelona Institute, Trini Castell, approach her. She put a bird-like hand on Diana's arm.
I was inspired by what you said, Miss Rayburn, she said. You are correct that rights, anyone's rights, are not to be discarded lightly.
Thank you, said Diana, more than a little surprised. Trini Castell gave her a quick smile and scurried away, leaving Diana with a clear view of the dais. Zara stood at its edge, her gaze fixed on Diana. In the pale light filtering through the window, the naked hatred on her face, far more than anyone might feel over a past insult, was clear as day. Shuddering, Diana turned and hurried from the hall. Katerina's suspicious confluence of ley lines turned out to be in a small desert park near the Antelope Valley Freeway, famous for its massive sandstone formations. Both Helen and Aline seemed faintly surprised that Mark and Christina were planning to go out on patrol, but they hadn't done anything to stop them, as if they reluctantly acknowledged that patrolling was a normal part of Shadowhunter life, and the sooner everyone got back to normal life, the better. The drive from Malibu, they'd taken Diana's truck, which had been left in the parking lot at the Institute, reminded Christina of long ambling road trips she'd taken with Emma. Windows down in the truck, music playing low on the speakers, beach turning to highway, turning to desert, as the sun went down in a haze of fire.
Mark had his long legs up on the dashboard and would sometimes turn his head to look at her as they rolled along in silence. The weight of his gaze felt like skin against her skin, like a touch. The Vasquez Rocks Park closed at sunset, and the dirt parking lot was empty when Christina cruised the truck into it and turned off the engine. They collected their weapons from the back of the truck, snapping on wrist protectors and buckling weapons belts. Christina strapped a long sword and her trusted balisong to her belt, while Mark found a ruined black whip and cracked it a few times. He wore a look of pleasure on his face as it snaked across the darkening sky. They had ruined themselves before they left. Christina could see Mark's night vision rune gleaming black against his throat as they passed under the lights of the ranger station and crossed into a dirt path that wound through scrub among rocks that twisted and folded like envelopes. Christina breathed deeply. Of all the things she loved about California, she loved the scent of the desert the most. Clear air mixed with juniper, manzanita, and sage. The sky opened above them like a secret told, scattered with a million stars. They passed a wooden sign for a trail just as a massive rock formation rose ahead of them, nearly blocking out the moon. "The ley line confluence," Mark said, pointing. Christina didn't ask him how he knew. Fairies had a sense for such things. They moved closer to the rocks, which rose above them in tilted slabs, like the remains of a spaceship that had crashed into the sand. Christina's boots crunched into the sand, the sound loud in her ears thanks to her audio rune. A sharp insect-like sound buzzed behind her. She turned, Mark frowning at the sensor in his hand. "It's making a buzzing noise, but not one I've heard before," he said. Christina turned around slowly. The desert stretched around her, a carpet of black and brown and dim gold. The sky was dark velvet. "I don't see anything." "We should wait here," said Mark. "See if it happens again." Christina was in no mood to hang around under the romantic moon with Mark. "I think we should keep moving." "Christina," Mark said, "you seem wroth with me." Christina rolled her eyes. "Nothing gets by you, Mark Blackthorne." Mark lowered the sensor. "Last night, it wasn't that I didn't want to. I did want to." Christina blushed furiously. "It's not that, Mark," she said. "You can want to or not want to. It's your business. It was that you lied." "Humans lie," he said, his bicolored eyes suddenly blazing. "Mortals lie to each other every day, especially in matters of love. Is it that my lie wasn't good enough? Should I be more practiced?" "No," she whirled on him. "I like that you don't lie, Mark. It is why I was so... Mark, can't you understand? I didn't expect you to lie to me."
"You saw me lie to Kieran," he said.
"Yes, but that was to save lives," she said. "Unless you're telling me that you not wanted to have sex with me has something to do with saving lives, which I find hard to believe."
"I did want to," Mark exploded. "One thing you must understand, I did want to be with you in that way, and always, and that is not a lie."
Christina sank down on a low rock. Her heart was pounding, and she just said the word sex, which horribly embarrassed her.
"Then I don't understand why you did it," she said in a small voice. "Were you trying to spare someone? Kieran?"
"I was trying to spare you," he said, his voice dark and hard, like late winter ice.
"Spare me what?"
"You know who you are," he cried, startling her. She looked up at him, not understanding. It was not as if she were a stranger to him, or to anyone. What did he mean?
"Kieran called you a princess of the Nephilim, and rightly," he said.
The moon was out fully, and the silver-white light illuminated his hair like a halo. It illuminated his eyes, too, wide and gold and blue and full of pain.
"You are one of the best examples of our people I have ever known. Shining, righteous, virtuous. You are all of the good things I can think of, and all of the things I would like to be, and know I never can. I do not want you to do anything, that later you would regret. I do not want you to later realize how far down from your standards you reached when you reached for me.